Okay. So, as I say, a bit of intellectual autobiography, I've got some views about space-time that kind of come under the heading space-time functionalism. And I think that might be a useful view for thinking about emergent space-times, but it never occurred to me it was going to do any work in helping you work out how space-time was emergent. So I very naively, many years ago, thought, well, I'd better work out what emergence means before I try and talk about space-time emergence. And I went down a sort of rabbit hole from which I haven't recovered and wrote quite a few papers that had nothing to do with space-time. But then I just buried my head down a rabbit hole for a year or two and picked it up to realize that some space-time functionalism had become quite trendy. And people were claiming, in particular, this is paper by Wittrich and Lamb, that was claiming that space-time functionalism itself was going to give you a theory of space-time emergence. I think that's mad. I still think it's mad. But I think it's worth talking about why. While my head was kind of buried in the sand, a couple of papers were written, one by David, another by Sam Baron, that also explained why this view is sort of mad. So I want to add to that voice and say, look, you can't think that space-time functionalism itself, or indeed functionalism in general, does much for you in the way of helping with theories of emergence, even the very weak kind that I like to discuss in physics. But it's useful to go through it and draw some further morals. I mean, one thing is that lots of these accounts have assumed that something particular is going on in the case of space-time emergence, and I actually think that most of what's said in these debates applies much more generally, at least to theoretical physics. So I think that's a point worth making, that some of these morals in this debate apply quite broadly. I also think that there's something wrong with the game being played and that that hasn't been sufficiently highlighted. So I think that Wittrich and Lamb, despite being very knowledgeable about physics, think that we're really going to affect a kind of functional reduction of some sort by kind of just staring at quantum gravity and finding realizers for functional roles. And I don't think that's ever how the theoretical relations have worked in the past in physics, and it's not how they'll work now. So most of this is going to be about space-time, but as I say, lots is sort of applicable much more broadly about how we think about weak emergence and reduction within physics and the role that functionalism might or might not play. Okay, so here's an overly crowded introduction. I'll give a bit of background, say where I'm coming from, outline the reasons why Wittrich and Lamb might have said what they said, and then explain why that's not right. So these arguments by David and Sam Baron. I'll draw some intermediate morals that are slightly in conflict with, at least for example, what Sam Baron says exactly in his paper. So his paper is called Curious Case of Space-Time Emergence, and I just think everything he says in his paper goes for most things in physics. So I don't think this case of space-time is very curious. And then I'll try and work out what we should say about emergent space-time and end with a slightly pessimistic conclusion. All right, so here's something I think is pretty definitely correct. That's the kind of thing it's correct for most concepts in science, but you know, space-time's a functional concept. That is, a field or object is spatiotemporal by virtue of playing a certain kind of role in our theory. It's space-time by virtue of what it does, not what it is. So I'm intending that as a form of conceptual realizer functionalism, kind of pretty metaphysically deflationary in that sense. What you do when you're trying to interpret your theory is you think, you know, what object in my theory best plays the role of space-time? And that turns out to be really useful, both in theory creation, theory interpretation, solving puzzles in various places in classical theory. So a lot of my work has involved thinking about finding what the space-time role is in general relativity and how we might use that to interpret other classical theories. Now, it occurs to me and others that this kind of view, views that are kind of not too kind of punctually container substantivalist about space-time, space-time doesn't have to be the categorical background for all things, might be quite useful for thinking about how space-time could be emergent. So some, maybe all, theories of quantum gravity lack space-time at the fundamental level in some sense. So lots of physicists and philosophers think that we'll need to understand the kind of space-time that we appear to live in and the kind of space-time that we posit in general relativity as a non-fundamental entity. Two comments on this. emergence in this context, in the mouths of physicists and in the mouths of philosophers, it almost always means weak emergence, perhaps very weak emergence, depending on where your weakness standards lie. The standard thing to say, following a sort of paper by Jeremy Butterfield that everyone kind of picked up on the terminology from, is that emergent behavior is novel and robust behavior, and is compatible with at least theoretical reduction. Okay. It's not that I think that space-time functionalism has nothing to do with emergent space-time. I do think that it helps us to accommodate the idea that space-time is non-fundamental. And that's because once you accept that to be space-time is just to fill a functional role, there's nothing in the concept of space-time that seems to be telling you that it couldn't be something non-fundamental that filled that role. Whereas if you have this sort of categorical container view of space-time, the space-time must be the fundamental container, then an emergent space-time seems like a contradiction in terms. So now things are going to depend on what you think about emergence elsewhere. So if you're happy to reify non-fundamental entities to say that emergent entities are perfectly real and they're part of our ontology, then it's going to make perfect sense to say that whatever plays the space-time role in some theory is rightly thought of as an emergent or non-fundamental entity, and hence that space-time is emergent or non-fundamental. If you're otherwise inclined towards strong reductionism, and you believe the only available role fillers for the space-time role are going to be fundamental entities, you'll either have to see space-time as something fundamental or think it's reduced in some sense to something fundamental, or conclude there's no space-time, or be a limitivist or something. But the point is, the functionalist view leaves all the options on the table and it can be combined with the emergent views. So that's sort of why it could be helpful in this debate, not because it's going to push you to any particular view. The whole point is that space-time allows for emergent space-time rather than mandates or explains it. And if you want to claim that space-time is emergent in a given theory, or in a given theoretical context, you're going to have to give an account of emergence, and then you're going to have to establish that the space-time structure that you've identified via your space-time functionalism is emergent given your account of emergence. So I never thought that the view did any of that work. I still don't. You can have. We can think about different ways our theoretical physics might work out. So one thing you could do is have a theory of quantum gravity where right there in the theory of quantum gravity there's something fairly obviously picking out, filling the space-time role. So one case I've looked at is a version of non-commutative quantum gravity where you can actually pretty easily identify something that corresponds to inertial structure. And this is going beyond this talk, but my view is that the role for space-time is the role of describing the structure of inertial frames, a particular kind of space-time functionalism. So you might kind of almost find this directly popping out of a version of quantum gravity. And then the relationship between space-time general relativity and quantum gravity is going to be very intimate indeed. But you might have another theory where you're taking some very complex mathematical function, bunch of continuum limits to get, say, the metric of general relativity out of your theory, and you have a much more distant relationship. And on lots of accounts of emergence, you might think that in the first of these cases, you don't have an emergent space-time, and in the second of these cases, you do. But again, space-time functionalism is working in both. It's not updating that description. Okay. So here's a puzzle. This is paper by Lam and Wycliffe. You take it that the job of space-time functionalism is not just to allow for the emergence of space-time, but to explain it. And I mean, already should be raising some red flags. Their mechanism for this is Kim's view of functional reduction, which is a puzzling thing to use in an account of emergence. But they say, look, you know, what we've got to do if we want to account for emergent space-times is we've got to do this thing. First of all, we've got to take our higher level properties or entities, in this case, spatiotemporal properties or the property of being space-time, and we need to functionalize them, so give them a functional definition in terms of their causal or functional role, your Ramsey sentence, if that's what you're into. And then the second part is to explain how lower level properties, so in this case quantum gravity properties, can fill that functional role. And Lam and Wycliffe think that you can be completely neutral on whether this is a model, I mean obviously Kim meant it as a model of reduction. They think you can just be neutral on whether it's a model of reduction or emergence. And after some pushing by me, they eventually put in a little hedge that said you might need, if stuff was novel and robust in this model, it could be. emergent, which wasn't quite my criticism. But I still think this is going to cast some light on inter-theoretic relations or inter-level relations when you don't have pre-existing notions about them. Why on earth would you start talking about functionalism here? Well, I'm not sure they articulate this completely, but I think this is the kind of reasoning. If you want to think of one entity as emergent relative to some other level, you need two things. You need novelty and dependence, and that's at least one of the few things pretty much everyone agrees on in the emergence debate. And lots of existing accounts of dependence have rely on composition, rely on part-whole relations, and there are plenty of good reasons to think that emergent space-times aren't going to be very good categories for things that you can think of as composed out of non-spatiotemporal parts. One nice thing about Sam Barrow, if you go through that argument in quite a lot of detail, I think that's right. But it's also intuitively right. You can see that it's a very odd thing to say that the space-time we live in is parts of spatiotemporal themselves. So to think of it as composed or in part-whole relations relative to some non-spatiotemporal is very odd. So we need another model of dependence. And the notion, the idea might be that functional dependence offers a kind of non-mereological notion of dependence that's going to help us here. So that's a perfectly good kind of basic idea. I don't think, unfortunately, it gets you very far. But, I mean, functionalism doesn't always betoken dependence of any kind, right? We use functional definitions in lots of contexts where neither reduction or emergence are at issue. So, consider the case of general relativity. This is where some of my work has been directed, following on from work about Harvey Brown. You're just in theory, you're thinking about general relativity, and you think, you can ask yourself questions like, what represents space-time in general relativity? Now, there's an orthodox answer, but there are people who don't agree. And so you can ask yourself, is the metric field space-time? And one thing you can do is note the various ways that the metric field of general relativity plays the space-time role. And nobody, at least I don't think I'm giving an account of the reduction or emergence of space-time right there. That's not a functional reduction, it's just picking out a concept functionally and then finding its realizer in a theory. We're all at one level. Nothing terribly exciting is going on. So it's a bit puzzling that this sort of suddenly, you know, you write higher and lower level into this thing and suddenly we're talking about emergence and reduction. Indeed, I think that's the kind of cheat that goes on here, right? I mean, the moment you write down that kind of Kim functional reduction definition, you've presupposed that you had started with two notions of level. You started with the notion of a higher level property and lower level property. And that can give you some help in reduction, because you start with a putative higher level property, and if you go, it's really realized by the lower level property, you can understand that you might have, by some lower level property, you might have a model of reduction. But the whole point, at least as I see it, of an account of emergence is to elucidate the notion of a level in the first place. So first of all, if you show that space-time is really a lower level thing, you definitely haven't got emergence. That'll be the sort of better version of this argument. But secondly, if you start with a definition that presumes you already understand levels, you're not going to be able to use that definition to tell you anything about the level structure of our world. And accounting emergence is doomed to one. Okay. So this argument, a version, better version, an extension, justification of this argument has been offered independently by Sam Barron and David. So here's a brief version. Let's just assume realizer functionalism for the moment. Things are roughly the same with role functionalism, unless you do some work somewhere else. Assume realizer functionalism, so the realizer of the space-time role just is space-time. All there is to being space-time is being the property that realizes the space-time role, right? If we find a realizer of the space-time role in the fundamental theory, then the fundamental theory posits space-time. So we don't have a non-spatiotemporal fundamental theory. So if the fundamental theory posits space-time, then space-time's not emergent. So pretty straightforwardly, it doesn't look like there's any way this could be an account of space-time emergence. And it doesn't matter what extra accounts of emergence I've got built in. That's just the nature of the game that we're in. So you can't use this kind of functionalism to tell you about the emergence. You can only escape it if the realizer turns out to not to be a fundamental thing itself. But then the kind of inter-theoretic work isn't being done by the functional reduction. The inter-theoretic work is being done by your account of the non-fundamental realizer. What the relationship between the non-fundamental realizer and the fundamental. So you can only have emergent space-time and a functional definition if you've already got an account of what it is for some non-fundamental things to relate to the fundamental things. Sam Baron thinks that usually part-whole relations fill that role. So I'll say a bit more on that in a minute. I think he's wrong. Well, he's wrong in physics there in lots of cases. Okay. So what use are functional definitions to the study of interlevel relations? Well, again, just as I said at the beginning, I sort of see my based on functions as a palliative role here. If you have an account of the non-fundamental, if you already understand something about the relationship between the two levels, but you're worried that the non-fundamental realizer, by virtue of understanding that it's non-fundamental, is just not the right kind of thing to play the role, then space-time functionalism is going to help ease your pain. Because if you thought that I have some account of how superpositions of spin foam networks and loop quantum gravity in some continuum limit emerge to be a space-time metric, right? But I'm like, well, that's not the kind of thing I thought space-time with. Well, then the functionalist can come along and say, look, you don't have valid thoughts about what kind of thing space-time functionalism is over and above what role it plays. So it's useful there, but not beyond that. And none of that really depends on the fact that I kept on using the word space-time, right? Functional emergence just isn't a thing. And when I checked last night whether there are papers on functional emergence, they're creeping in places like chemistry. Functional emergence is not a thing. Let's make sure it doesn't become one, because it's very confused. That's moral one. Nothing to do with space-time. There's no such thing as functional emergence. Intermediate moral two. Baron, at least, thinks that this is particularly pressingly problematic for space-time physics, because space-time physics has a problem with composition. And he has the great bad fortune to use an example that to a subset of philosophers of physics is like waving a red flag. I can sort of imagine putting up a quote and this quote. And therefore you could divide philosophy of physics in two communities with this quote. There's a whole bunch of East Coast primitive ontologists who probably think it's kind of fine in some sense, and then there'd be a whole load of other people who have seen something out their ears at this quote. Or just the phrase a group of me the heebie-jeebies. Right, so here's what Baron... So Baron thinks, look, if I have a fixed functional definition of Q, and then I look at my fundamental theory and I identify a group of quarks as playing that role, we don't have this kind of... this sort of reductio argument go through, right? Because while it's true that no quark is a blue shoe, it's okay for a group of quarks to functionally realize a blue shoe. So because we have this part-whole relationship and we can make sense of the notion of a group of quarks, I can identify, sort of in my fundamental theory, I can like draw a ring around this group of quarks. This group of quarks, look, I'm pointing to them. They're a blue shoe. So we think that, I'm perfectly happy to believe that in the case of like Lego blocks, this argument really goes through quite well, by the way. But he thinks that it's going to go through and he happens to choose quarks, which are... He was going to choose fundamental particles. That's such a bad one. So Baron thinks problems with part-whole relations are specific to the space-time case. And I'll try and keep this to a mini rant. But you know, if one thing happened in the metaphysics literature, if anyone could never use a phrase like a group of quarks, that would be wonderful. So I admit, if you go to Wikipedia and you look up what a proton is, we'll be told it's hadron, we'll be told it's a composite particle, not a composite matter. Yeah, a mereological composition. I understand it so well. The proton in the kind of physics you're taught in school, and to some extent undergrad, is to be told it has to be quarks in it. And you think, well, that's great. I mean, I know. Lego bricks together and I get a proton. Fantastic. But here, and admittedly, we were treading into dangerous interpretation of quantum mechanics waters, but here are uncontroversial facts, I think. But I'd like to tell you about quarks. It should problematize that. The quarks are described by quantum chromodynamics. That's a kind of quantum field theory. On the surface of it, at least, quantum field theories are about fields. The relationship between the quark and field is kind of a complicated one, but, you know, in some sense, a quark is a sort of first perturbative approximation of a different kind of excitation of a field. Here's a fact about quantum field theory. Particle number is a quantum number in quantum field theory. And fields fairly generically exist in superpositions of quantum number states. You know when you hear that quantum particles exist in delocalized states, they don't have a definite location. They're in a superposition of lots of location states. The same thing's true of numbers of quarks in a quark field. The mass of three quarks is 1% of the mass of a proton. Most of the mass of a proton comes about when we calculate perturbative additions to the three-quark model that correspond to quark-antiquark pairs and virtual gluons. And the right way to think of quark-antiquark pairs, for the record, is not as little real particles that pop in and out of existence continuously. What we're doing when we do a perturbative expansion of quantum field theory is we're trying to capture all the funny things going on in a superposed quantum field. And the way we capture that is by the sort of contributions from these virtual particles. While there's some expectation value for measuring them if you find them, the right thing to say on pretty much any sensible interpretation of quantum mechanics is not that an unmeasured system really has quarks popping in and out of existence. So there's just kind of a mess, a quantum mess that becomes a sensible quantum field theory to some extent going on in a proton. And there might be sort of answers under certain circumstances, the question of how many quarks, for example, are in a proton, but it's not the kind of thing that is, they're not generically in eigenstates of proton number. And that's even before we think about the fact that if you think the real ontology has fields, these fields are highly non-local. And they're just not the kinds of things that I really can't just, you know, talk about the gluons in this region. That's just never sensible to quantum particles, and it's sort of even worse. For gluons themselves, which also never exist on their own. So blue shoes are not groups of gluons. So the point of that, recapping laurels, is that nothing in this discussion thus far has been particularly specific to space-time. Part-whole compositional accounts of dependence are inappropriate for most, maybe all, microphysics. I mean, basically, once you get into quantum realms, I think that our sort of standard metaphysical models of dependence aren't going to work. Not specific to the space-time emergence case. It might sound sexy to talk about space-time emergence, but you don't need to be that complicated or hypothetical to start thinking about these problems. And functional dependence doesn't help us in any of these cases. Or indeed in the part-whole cases where you didn't need functional notion of dependence in the first place. So if I want to understand how my daughter's Duplo model depends on the bricks, I obviously don't need functional dependence. Good. Okay, so, by the way, this is going to end up being really short, so we'll go for things. Or you can interrupt me and ask horrible questions. All right, so how do we respond to this? What should we say? So now we're back in the space-time realm. So the intermediate morals are just to say all of these dilemmas that we've been worrying about are kind of generic to theoretical physics, in my view. And we need the right answer to them. But now we're back thinking about these different papers and what we say in response to this puzzle of how can we account for the emergence of space-time. And Barron pretty much responds to the dilemma by saying so much the worse for genuine space-time emergence. It's not going to make sense to think that space-time could emerge from a fundamental theory. Because, you know, space-time, you're going to have to say that space-time doesn't have a functional real answer. But we can say certain spatiotemporal properties like location are realized. And if you're worried about problems of empirical incoherence, which people are sometimes with emergent space times because they're worried you don't have local viables, kinds of things that you can just kind of building block up to observations. Worry about that in the first place. But, they're solved by appeal to these partial functionalized properties. So space-time doesn't emerge, but we can nonetheless explain spatiotemporal experiences because they're approximately true. There's a bit of a funny thing here, which is that he seems to think that some spatiotemporal properties do emerge, but they're not subject to a version of the argument he's just given, which again didn't seem to depend on having space-time as a whole in it. So I don't think he can think that. I think that entire argument reveals certainly that at least Baron's notion of emergence is more restrictive than many physicists. I mean, suppose you found a whole bunch of spatiotemporal-like properties in a fundamental theory, and then you had a really good account, given lots of interior relations, about how the appearance of, how general relativity came to be valid in the vast majority of domains. I think by most people's standards, that would be a sufficient account of the emergence of space-time itself. So it seems to me that in this kind of picture, it's not that it might not be how a picture ends up working, but all of the action is in understanding the approximate validity of the space-time picture in our domain. That's the bit of science that you'll be really interested in once we have a theory of quantum gravity. Indeed, it's a bit of physics one's going to have to do, because realistically no one thinks you can do quantum gravity without showing how you at least approximately get out all theories. It's one of the kind of sanity checks on a theory of quantum gravity. Again, David says, if I get anything wrong, about it, because you understand this much better than I do. Full confession, this is very, very recent thinking. So I take it David's response is to say, look, yes, by the way, we definitely do need to provide some kind of alternative account of inter-level relations. He's going to advocate a kind of role functionalism, but just saying I want to be a role functionalist doesn't help, because then the realizer of your higher order property is still in the micro physics. But if you have a non-flat model of realization, which I take it is the notion that there's a notion of higher level realizers, right? Is that all fair enough? I've never come across the phrase non-flat model of realization before. Philosopher of physics trying to do metaphysics. So a non-flat model of realization, I think, effectively does what I think of as giving some other accounts of inter-level relations. And David talks about two possible models for this. So one is Laurie Paul's non-spatiotemporalist mereology, and the other is what he calls causal-effect emergence relations, but arise in some models of the fundamental theory. I'll say something very brief about each of those. Laurie Paul worries that mereology is spatiotemporalist, which seems to be the worry that we had. When you think about breaking something up into parts, the natural way to do that is to think of the parts as located in space-time, and the kind of mereological fusion as being ways of fusing the regions therein, etc. But she thinks you could have an ontology that's generated by bundling or fusing qualitative and location properties that aren't spatiotemporal. I think she's assuming that there is a space of some sort. It might not be space-time, but there's some kind of space in which we can locate properties and qualities, and you're going to perform some kind of fusion operation on parts of that space. In a sense, great, that's very programmatic, right? Do you have to have a unique base space or phase space for every theory? One might worry about that. It's not obvious, it's not just, in cases of quantum gravity, it's not just that there's not a space-time these things live in. Sometimes it's that once you don't have something with space-time, you don't have a privileged space in the theory at all. That's one thing that can happen. So particularly, when you have some symmetries and duals, then you have more than one way of presenting a theory in different kinds of space. Or more trivially, once you lose the idea that there's certain degrees of freedom you think of as spatiotemporal, and maybe this, if you don't do it in physics, it's fairly obvious, it's not of how you choose some degrees of freedom to count as the ones with which you parameterize your space, and some degrees of freedom to call the properties within that space is pretty arbitrary. when I'm writing down, I can write down velocity spaces and phase spaces and all kinds of funky mathematical spaces. So I'm not quite sure. I mean, I suspect that non-spatial temporalist Mariology is going to presume you can always pick out a privileged space. That seems like a probably not a good assumption. Good, but you know, more power to you. I mean, like, the fact that non-spatial, if anyone's doing something that's not quite, you know, Lego Mariology, I'm super happy. And then one of the questions is going to be, how does it apply in the quantum realm? Way before you get to worrying about how it applies in quantum gravity. Good. The next thing is what David calls causal emergence. Yeah, am I allowed to call it nomologically contingent emergence? I like that name better. So David considers a case in which general relativistic space-time emerges causally from a spin foam. I'm a little worried. So spin foam is, you don't need to know much about it, but it's a non-spatio-putatively, this is the whole point of this debate, it's a non-spatio-temporal state of loop quantum gravity. And so the notion of causation and dynamical emergence seems extremely puzzling in that kind of situation. It seems like you need at very least a notion of dynamics that requires a prior notion of time. So I'm not sure I can make sense of the notion of, say, without somewhere else that the time is, time is very problematic in quantum gravity for lots of reasons, but without somewhere else that time is coming in from, I don't know if I can make sense of a spin foam evolving into a spatio-temporal state. But I mean, I could be, I'm happy to be persuaded that I'm wrong about that. Conceptualizing things in quantum gravity is a bit of a fool's game anyway. But one sense in which space-time might be realized by a fundamental theory, but not fundamental theory, that sounds like a really plausible thing in a case where we might want to say space-time is emergent, is if the realizing structure is nomologically contingent. It appears in some models of our quantum gravity and not others. So that might be a really nice clear-cut state where we have a reason to think that this structure is not part of the kind of fundamental ontology and that it's not part of the kind of things you always put into a quantum gravity model, but it's a structure that is nonetheless there in the fundamental theory that, so I mean, I don't know if you want to say it's, you have to have a particular sense of emergence for that, but it's a structure that's contingently there in our world, and so we live in a spatio-temporal world, but it didn't have to be that way according to the fundamental law. And that seems like, yeah, that seems like it could be a good notion of the emergence of space-time. Me. So, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom. None of these are bad. They all seem like they could be true. I'm not sure what game we're playing or why we're playing it at this stage. And I'm not sure, in the case of Richard and Lamb, what game they put themselves to be playing. So one of the things that's going on here is that all participants in the debate are trying to get a handle on metaphysical or ontological emergence, not the emergence of one theory from another. So I assume that if anyone wanted to do the emergence of one theory from another, they'd realize that's just really tough physics that no one yet knows how to do. If you had good interdiuretic relations between general relativity and a theory of quantum gravity, really good ones, that theory of quantum gravity, that's, you know, that's, they're probably not, I think you have to have empirical results for Nobel Prizes, but yeah, it's really good theoretical stuff. And we only have it in the most tenuous of senses, hints. So everyone here, what they're trying to do is get a direct handle on metaphysical and ontological emergence, or at least how there could be such a thing in this particular case. But I'm not sure there are any other cases in science where we've tried to do that, or we should have been trying to do that. I mean, interesting problems of scientific metaphysical emergence or reduction don't get solved prior to trying to understand how theories work. They get solved in a big theoretical context where you try and make all sorts of links between the two things. And in particular, and again, I've got lots of experts in the room, and I knew bits of physics, so maybe I'm wrong, but I can't imagine any situation where what we did when we wanted to reduce something was actually functionalize something and then go directly to the fundamental theory and just rummage around and try, you know, try putting together different things until we came up with something that filled a functional role. That's not what we do. What we do is we develop a complicated theoretical construct connecting two theories, and only when we've done that might we look in the fundamental theory and say what kinds of functions are playing roles up at this level. So there's something funny that's happened in philosophy of space and time, I think just because it's really exciting, I think we're trying to run ahead of ourselves. This is where I become pessimistic. So here's a much simpler case. But it's still a really problematic case, right? But it's a case we understand so much better. And I mean, if I don't know what to say about metaphysical emergence in this case, I'm definitely not going to be able to say anything constructive, I think, in the space-time case. So let's just look at thermodynamics. So here's one good thing about thermodynamic variables, I take it. It would be really tough not to be a functionalist about a thermodynamic variable. What I'll talk about here is free energy. That is the energy available to do work. I don't have a definition of work, etc., but I'm hoping no one will doubt that that's just a totally functional concept. It's really a question about a property of systems such that a system can do a certain kind of thing. Archetypally functional. And most thermodynamic variables are like that. They're very much defined as equations of state, things with relationships to others, work and heat, right? So how does one go about linking thermodynamic variables to a lower level of particle dynamics? Well, what you definitely don't do is go, I imagine I have a big cluster of molecules, and I'm just going to rummage around a cluster of molecules for some property they might have that corresponds to the free energy. What you in fact do is invent an entire theory called statistical mechanics that has whole departments dedicated to it in order to understand the relationship between particle dynamics and thermodynamics. So I like work and heat because I think there's the kind of thing I think is going on in kinds of emergence in physics. The work-heat distinction is totally crucial to thermodynamics. The distinction between, stuff I can do, work, just the heat. There's a sort of heat energy in a very attenuated sense associated with glass, and then there's, perhaps some potential energy of some sort, etc. And it can do work, or it can, and it has some temperature. And abstracting on the basis of making assumptions about what's happening with work and heat are totally crucial for how we offer thermodynamic explanations. But it's really kind of obvious at an intuitive level that that's a distinction that's incredibly hard to track at the level of particle dynamics. If you kind of think both things have something to do with the kinetic energies of particles. Like, I've just got a lot of particles whizzing around. This glass, I've just got this sort of glass moving across the table, how do I distinguish between the useful bits of the energy and the non-useful bits of the energy, etc. I'm sliding it and it could bang something, but how do I tell the difference between the chaotic motions and the motions across? It doesn't look like there's a principled way to do so when you're kind of zooming in at the level of the particle dynamics. So working heat are a little bit complicated because they're, heat only makes sense as a transferred quantity, etc. So let's choose a property that's a bit simpler to attribute to a system at a time to make it a little easier case. So that's the free energy. That's the energy available to do work. So still crucially related to the work-heat distinction. I'm feeling this is really uncontroversial. This application is a little bit controversial, but we do have a pretty good understanding of the mathematical relationship between that and the system of mechanical variables. So this is the thermodynamic free energy, constant temperature, and this is the log of something called the partition function. That's what a real bridge looks like, right? I'm starting to think that this infinity betokens a failure of reduction. I think this is as good as it gets, right? And we understand really well how to model the thermodynamics in terms of how to model the thermodynamic free energy in terms of system mechanics. So I think that's enough for theoretical reduction, or if you don't think it's enough, you're just setting bars. It's enough for the things I care about in theoretical reduction. Does it make sense to think that the world's really composed of particles and we can understand the relation, the levels in terms of one another? Given Sackler, we understand why thermodynamics works. I mean, I also, as it happens, have a view of emergence where I think that thermodynamic variables are emergent in a kind of weak sense. I think it's an interesting one enough to give you a level description of the world. On that second bit, partly because I'm very wishy-washy about metaphysics in general. And so moving to thermodynamic descriptions allows for novel explanatory abstractions that track real dependence relations in the world. That's what I think it amounts to. So thermodynamics is emergent. But the point about all of this is not to give another talk about human presence, but to say all of that's become an element of theory, not by looking for realizers. At no point did we try and do this reduction by rummaging around in particle dynamics and looking for the realizers of thermodynamic functional properties. And I mean, what I want to say is we should do that theoretical work first, and then all of your ontological and metaphysical reduction pictures will follow. But I find I understand the relationship between statistical mechanics and thermodynamics pretty well, and I still don't really know what to say about the ontology. I mean, I guess as long as you've got a group of classical particles, you could think of thermodynamic properties as very odd counterfactual complex properties of ensembles of particles. So counterfactual because when you took it's the property of having a partition function such that if you took the partition function to infinity, it would have a particular kind of value. That's what having a particular thermodynamic free energy appears to correspond to. I don't know if that really tells you when you think of ensembles of particles as ontologically distinct from particles. And it also sort of seems tangential to the issue of whether thermodynamic variables are interesting. And if you move to quantum statistical mechanics, the picture is complex still, because I don't know if picking out ensemble of particles is going to be the kind of thing you can straightforwardly do. You can attribute states to particular kinds of quantum systems. Okay, so I guess my final model, defeatist and uninteresting, but is that some of the current literature on space-time motion is trying to do for space-time something that we just can't do in much simpler and better understood cases, and that's kind of a fool's errand. In order to understand emergent space-time, we need to understand how spatiotemporal theory like general relativity emerges from more fundamental physics. That's a great project, but I would put it to the philosophy community that no one in the philosophy community qualified to do it. It's highly questionable if there's anyone in the physics community qualified to do that. So that's work for physicists, and of course we can scrutinize it. Once you start to get models, putative models that have emerged, that's really interesting, and we're going to learn interesting things from them. But I don't think we're going to make a contribution to how that relationship is going to work. There's lots of really important, where I actually think the action is and the work to be done is understanding higher level theories. So it often turns out that some of these questions of physicists turn on tough interpretational questions about the theory that they're trying to reach, or what they're thinking about quantum mechanics, or how they interpret general relativity. And there I think philosophers have something to offer. But I don't think there's really important work for philosophers in trying to understand metaphysical reduction and emergence in the absence of a theoretical understanding that's already been taught by physicists. Okay, conclusions. Just a recap. Standard metaphysical accounts of dependence don't apply in the case of non-fundamental space-times, but they don't apply in lots of other cases. You should all be space-time functionalists anyway, because it's a great thing to think, but you shouldn't be space-time functionalists because you think it'll help you with space-time emergence. And understanding in this area needs to wait until the physicists have sorted themselves out. Right, thank you very much.